Okay, well, the title of tonight's presentation is the Age of Fragmentation, okay? And this is kind of the end product of, the result of the last 6,000 plus years of history, okay? It's taken us this long, well, really since the flood, if we want to do it that way. It's taken us this long to get here, but we're here. You know, we made it. And this is pretty important. Now, there's going to be some guys on here that are some absolute nutcases. And you're going to think, who are these guys? And but they're artists and musicians, and I can assure you that they've had that underneath effect. That just a layer below the surface that you might not recognize. Some of them are fairly well known, but a lot of them are not names that show up in the household, but they affect the artists, they affect the musicians. In particular, you're going to see one guy named John Cage. Now, John Cage, he's not somebody you probably ever heard of. He's probably one of the most influential underneath the surface musicians of modern times. An artifact in his honor just auctioned off last June at Christie's of New York in excess of $1 million. See, now you wouldn't pay that for it, but somebody would. See, that lets you know how influential that is. So, now there's a couple scenes here. You know, you just have to, there's some paintings. So, and like I say, these guys are in the nutcase department. So, you just have to know that that's where it's at. So I think we are ready.
Monet, Renoir, Pissarro, Sisley, and Degas were following nature, as it was then called, in their painting. They were impressionists. They painted only what their eyes brought them. But was there reality behind the light waves reaching their eyes? After 1885, Monet carried this to its conclusion, and reality tended to become a dream. With Impressionism, the door was open for art to become the vehicle for modern thought. As reality became a dream, Impressionism began to fall apart. These men, Cézanne, Van Gogh, Gauguin, Seurat, all great post-Impressionists, felt the problem, felt the loss of meaning. They set out to solve the problem, to find the way back to the reality, to the absolute, behind the individual things, behind the particulars. Ultimately, they failed. I am not saying that these painters were always consciously painting their philosophy of life, but rather that in their work as a whole, their worldview was often reflected. Cézanne reduced nature to what he considered its basic geometric forms. In this, he was searching for a universal which would tie all kinds of individual things in nature together. But this gave a broken, fragmented appearance to his pictures. In his bathers, there is much freshness, much vitality, an absolute wonder in the balance of the picture as a whole. But he portrayed not only nature, but man himself in fragmented form. I want to stress that I am not minimizing these men as men. To read Van Gogh's letters is to weep for the pain of this sensitive man. Nor do I minimize their talent as painters. Their work often has great beauty indeed. But their art did become the vehicle of modern man's view of fractured truth and life. As philosophy had moved from unity to fragmentation, so did painting. In 1912, Kandinsky wrote an article saying that insofar as the old harmony, that is, a unity of knowledge, had been lost, that only two possibilities remained, extreme abstraction or extreme naturalism. Both, he said, were equal. With this painting, modern art was born. Picasso painted it in 1907 and called it Les Damoiselles d'Avignon. It unites Cézanne's fragmentation with Gauguin's concept of the noble savage, using the form of the African mask, which was popular with the Parisian art circle of that time. In great art, technique is united with worldview. And the technique of fragmentation fits well with the worldview of modern man. A view of a fragmented world and fragmented man, and a complete break with the art of the Renaissance, which was founded on man's humanist hopes. Here, man is made to be less than man. Humanity is lost. Speaking of a part of Picasso's private collection of his own works, David Douglas Duncan says, "Of course, not one of these pictures was actually a portrait, but his prophecy of a ruined world. But Picasso himself could not live with this loss of the human. When he was in love with Olga, and later Jacqueline, he did not consistently paint them in a fragmented way. At crucial points of their relationship, he painted them as they really were, with all his genius, with all their humanity. When he was painting his own young children, he did not use fragmented techniques and presentation. I want you to understand that I am not saying that gentleness and humanness are never present in modern art. But as the techniques of modern art advanced, humanity was increasingly fragmented."
The opposite of fragmentation would be unity. And the old philosophic thinkers thought they could bring forth this unity from a humanist base. And then they gave this up. And the modern thinking has accepted fragmentation as a defeat, really. A defeat that human mentality, beginning from itself, can bring forth a unity of thought and of life. Now, by unity, what we mean is that which would include all of thought and all of life, and it can be achieved if indeed God has spoken and has not been silent. And in giving us the facts that man couldn't find for himself, there is a unity inside of which all that marvelous diversity, which then man can study, has a unified place, whether it's in knowledge or in values and in life.
It was Dadaism which carried the concept of everything being a matter of chance to its logical conclusion of the ultimate absurdity of everything, including humanity. This is Marcel Duchamp's Nude Descending a Staircase. Duchamp perhaps understood most clearly and consciously the absurdity of all things, including man, on the basis of modern man's worldview. Here he carried fragmentation further. The human being disappeared completely. He realized that this absurdity of all things included the absurdity of art itself. This is one of his ready-mades. He took any object near at hand and simply signed it. The philosophers from Rousseau, Kant, Hegel, and Kierkegaard onward had given up a hope of a unity of life and of knowledge, and had come to a fragmented concept of reality. Then the painters painted that way. However, the artists, being sensitive men, came more quickly to the understanding of what the end of this view would be, and that is that all things are absurd. The American Jackson Pollock is perhaps the clearest example of deliberately painting in a way that says all is chance. This is how Pollock went about creating some of his art. Thus, his paintings were a product of chance. But wait, is there not order in these lines of paint? Yes, because, you see, it is not really chance that shaped his canvases. The universe is not a random universe. It has order. The movement of this swinging can of paint follows the order of the universe itself. The universe is not what these painters said it is. It was a bankrupt humanistic philosophy which first taught that reason leads to pessimism and that optimism is only to be found in the area of non-reason. This basic idea filtered down to art and then to classical music and later to popular music. It started with Beethoven's Lost Quartets. You could not call these modern, but there was a shift from the previous music. In France, Claude Debussy opened the door for modern music. Many of us have a profound admiration for his music and enjoy it very much indeed. But Debussy did open the door, not to non-resolution, as the German composers did, but to fragmentation, a fragmentation parallel to the fragmentation in painting. A fragmentation which was a great influence on almost all the following composers of classical music, as well as the later forms of jazz and rock. In Germany, after Beethoven's quartets, came Wagner and Mahler, then Schoenberg with his 12-tone row. Here's perpetual variation, but never resolution. This is Karlheinz Stockhausen. You're listening to the published score of electronic music. Concern with the element of chance was part of Stockhausen's work. This ties him in with John Cage. Cage believed the universe is a universe of chance. To express this, he produced music by chance. Cage's music turned out to be sheer noise. Significantly, he entitled this composition, Music for Marcel Duchamp.
Oh,
John Cage was another one who could not live with his concept of a chance universe, because it does not fit the universe which exists. Cage was an expert in the knowledge of mushrooms. He himself said, "I became aware that if I approached mushrooms in the spirit of my chance operation, I would die shortly." His theory of the universe did not fit the universe that exists. Why is the airplane carefully formed and orderly, and what Cage produced is utter noise? Because the airplane must fly in the universe that exists, and there are orderly flow lines in the universe that exists. The universe is not what Pollock in his paintings and Cage in his music said it was. And because Cage's music does not fit what man is either, it had to become increasingly spectacular to keep us interested. Hey! What a contrast to Bach, who had much diversity and yet always resolution. Bach, as a Christian, believed that there was resolution for the individual and for history. As the music that came out of the biblical teaching of the Reformation was influenced by that worldview, so the worldview of modern man shapes modern music. Is this still art? Is it not rather a bare philosophic intellectual statement, separated from the fullness of who man is and what the universe is, tending to be only a bare intellectual statement rather than a work of art? It often has become anti-art art. After philosophy, art, and music, poetry, the novel, and drama became the vehicle for these ideas. In the English-speaking world, T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland came first.
Le Prince d'Aquitaine à la Tour Ebolique, these fragments I have shored against my ruin. Why, then I'll fit you. Hieronymo's mad again. Data, diadvam, damyata. Shanti, shanti, shanti.
You see, he matches a fragmented message with a fragmented form of poetry, just as Picasso opened the way for a fragmented concept of life in Les Demoiselles d'Avignon. So fragmented poetry in the English-speaking world began with T.S. Eliot's Wasteland. Later, Eliot became a Christian, and his form of writing changed from that of the Wasteland. More and more, philosophy was expressed, not as formal statements of philosophy as such, but rather in the novel and other art forms. Sartre wrote Nausea, Camus, The Stranger, and The Plague, and Simon de Beauvoir, L'Invité. In the 60s, many of the basic philosophic statements were made through the cinema. And being carried by the cinema, they reached a far wider circle of people than had ever been the case through painting or literature, let alone through the writings of the philosophers. Among these films were Silence and the Hour of the Wolf by Bergman, Juliet of the Spirits by Fellini, Blow Up by Antonioni, Belle du Jour by Buñuel. They showed pictorially and with great force what it is like if people are only machines, and also what it is like if people try to live in the area of non-reason. In the area of non-reason, there is no way to distinguish between right and wrong, or even between what is objectively true and that which is illusion or fantasy. A good example is Antonioni's Blow Up. The advertisement for the film reads, "Murder without guilt, love without meaning." In this film, there are no certainties concerning moral values and no human categories either. Blow Up has no hero. All one has is Antonioni's non-hero. All there is the camera, which just goes click, 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 and the human factor has disappeared. Some of the films of that period went even further. The Last Year of Marienbad, Juliet of the Spirits, The Hour of the Wolf, and Belle du Jour. They were saying something even more profound. They were saying that as modern man leaps into the area of non-reason to try to find his optimism without reason, that he not only does not have any categories for moral or human values, but he does not have any certainty upon which to distinguish between reality and illusion.
Picture has a realistic line. They are no dreams. They are
fantasies of the spirit. There's no difference between the dream and the reality.
Pronti a posto. Marita. Quando prendo uno. Questo è stato un po' di fantasia, quello che fa. Devo dire tutto, millimetro per millimetro. E là.
If it is my only way to live in reality, you know, it's for a creature, I think that what he does is only reality.
E urlate l'altalena dell'amore, tante volte dovete dire l'altalena dell'amore. Pronto? Come on!
To don't give meaning to the reality means that you don't understand no more reality. A reality can appear also like a monstrum, things without any meaning.
Bergman was a clear case at this point. He directed The Hour of the Wolf, where one cannot tell the difference between what is real and what is fantasy. Was what was being presented really happening, or was it in the mind of one of the characters? If people begin only from themselves and think that they live in a universe in which there is no personal God to speak, a universe such as Bergman indicated in his film Silence, then they have no final way to distinguish between reality and fantasy or illusion. But Bergman, like Sartre and Camus, could not live consistently with his own position, and therefore the background music for the film Silence is Bach's Goldberg Variations. Bergman said, "There is a small, holy part of the human being where music speaks." Bergman also said that while he was writing the script for the film Silence, that he had the music of Bach's Goldberg Variations playing in his home, and the music interfered with that which was being set forth in that film. The Christian knows why music speaks. He knows the people are not a product of chance. The people are made in the image of God. And on this basis, it is understandable that music is music to man. And because God has spoken in the Bible, there is not silence. And there are certainties concerning moral values and human values. And there are categories upon which to distinguish between reality and fantasy. For the people with the humanist position, this is not so. Within the humanist position, there is no base for knowing.
Christianity is not romantic. The Bible's not romantic about man. Man is seen as fallen. Man is seen as rebellion. Man is seen as rebellious against God, with all the goodness of God and with all the knowledge he has. On one hand, from the surrounding universe and its form and the mannishness of man, and on the other hand, from the more detailed knowledge of the Bible and the revelation in Christ. Man is a rebel. And we know Christian does not romantically think that this can be just leapt over. But having said that, a Christian is not a pessimist. He's not a pessimist on two levels. First of all, history's going someplace. And a part of the Christian message is that Christ is coming back. And this is the final solution. But every Christian who really understands the scripture, also every generation, he is waiting and fighting and struggling and doing all that he can, not only to see individuals become Christians, but the culture touched by these individual Christians.
Turn your Bibles to Jeremiah chapter 5. What has been will be, and what is has been. Solomon. Jeremiah chapter 5. We have a little discussion on the nation Judah as it is plunging toward its final elimination as an independent nation at the hands of the Babylonians. God, of course, ultimately being the one that's going to bring that about. Jeremiah chapter 5, verse 26. Says, for wicked men are found among my people. They watch like fowlers, lying in wait. They set a trap. They catch men. Like a cage full of birds, so their houses are full of deceit. Therefore, they have become great and rich. They are fat. They are sleek. They also excel in deeds of wickedness. They do not plead the cause of the orphan, that they may prosper. And they do not defend the rights of the poor. Shall I not punish these people, declares the Lord? And on a nation such as this, shall I not avenge myself? The appalling and horrible thing has happened in the land. The prophets prophesy falsely. Priests rule on their own authority. And my people love it so. But what will you do at the end of it? What happened in Judah is what's happening in Western civilization as a whole. Now, you take these particular nutcases. John Cage, for example, he's the guy sitting there at the piano. Okay, that's a composition called 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Okay, and it's 7 movements of silence. That's what it is. Now, it happens that 4 minutes and 33 seconds is 273, which is the number of degrees below 0 Celsius. It's absolute zero. I don't know if there's any connection there. But that's his composition, 7 movements of silence, okay? Now, you're thinking, how is a nutcase like this? I mean, you saw him walking off there, you know, a big, you know, promo grin on his face. Well, somebody's paying these guys. See, if you're an artist, you know, a musician or composer, you have to find some patron. You have to find somebody that finances you. So you have to ask the question, who's backing these guys? Who wants fragmentation. See, the music, for example, is for those of us who are untrained in such areas, it's a little hard to, you know, figure out what fragmentation is. But you can tell when he starts off with that piece from Beethoven as an introduction, it's a section that doesn't seem like it's going anywhere. And then when you get to Debussy, or however you pronounce that guy's name, you know, when they're playing the flute, there's no pattern to it. I mean, it you know, kind of goes this way, this way. You couldn't take and write a Christian hymn and put it to that music. It doesn't go anywhere. See, it's fragmented. It's like it's out in space. See, and in the same way with the poetry, T.S. Eliot. See, those are made up words. See, some of the words are real. Some of the words are made up. The idea is it isn't going anywhere. See, and it's part of it's the result of the philosophy. The philosophy is developed. These are continue to be the expression. You know, when humanism it becomes elevated, then man is at the center. But the conclusion is that everything is futile. It's not going anywhere. When you as an individual, a humanist, you start contemplating your own death, and you're trying to figure out, you know, where's this going? See, the most hopeful answer you can come with is you're not going anywhere. Okay. I always remember one of the songs by Creedence Clearwater Revival, where it was the line that says, I ain't sure that there's a heaven, but I pray there ain't no hell. Okay. Now, people are conscious of that. And so they have nowhere to go but to be discouraged. Now, the Impressionists, you know, where the guys start with the art, see, it shouldn't surprise you that started in Paris. See, Paris was already a spiritually bankrupt emotional case, you know, going way back to the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in, was it 1572 or thereabouts, you know, leading up to the French Revolution of 1789, after the demise of Napoleon, in a very short time, France went through 6 socialist revolutions. Okay, and it's about this time then that the Impressionists developed in Paris. Now, Pablo Picasso was a Spaniard, but he went to Paris. And that's where he did his work. Now, it's kind of interesting. I'm doing a little research on Picasso, and he received 2 major awards in his life. In 1950, he received the Stalin Peace Prize. And in 1962, not too long before he died, he received the International Lenin Peace Prize. Now, you should start to see some connections there, shouldn't you? See, why is it these nutcases, why is their art somehow held up as magnificent? You know, when it makes absolutely no sense. You know, you look at that stuff, you know, say, what is this? And that's supposedly great art. See, or a music composition that's absolute gibberish. Or atonal music. You know, the no repetition of any sound or any order. See, why are these guys elevated, and why do they become the underlying influence for all the people that go a little bit more for popular consumption? How does that happen? I was thinking, you know, you got to be promoted by the media. You know, the Beatles would have been squat if the media hadn't promoted them back in 66, 67, 68, they would have, you know, they'd been nothing. But the media is capable of creating the hype. You know, like we were talking about Britney Spears here a couple of weeks ago. You think she's such a great singer that she would have done it without media hype? See, it's, you know, or how about Madonna? You know, I mean, where do these people come from? Reversing the point, If George Washington was living today, he'd receive less publicity than Ron Paul from the mainstream coverage. See, they make sure guys like that get zero coverage while they're promoting the nutcases. See, so you have to start asking the question, who is behind the media? See, who controls the media? Why is it a guy like Picasso gets the Stalin Peace Prize and the International Lenin Peace Prize? Why is this coming to these guys? See, well, there's a purpose for the fragmentation. See, there's a reason for the promotion. You'd be happy to know that John Cage, for example, produced his music on the basis of his conversion to Taoist thought and follower of Zen Buddhism. What has been will be, and what is what has been. Eastern thought, a long time ago, figured out that if man is the center, then it goes nowhere, and that this present existence is an illusion. Now, the Hindu word for that is Maya. See, and that's how they view it. This present existence is a Maya. It's an illusion. See, the modern man is, in rejecting the Bible, is backing into the arms of the East. And the gurus are riding their chariots westward. That's what's going on. Why would the big boys want fragmentation? Remember, there's three forces at work. There's the basic rebellion of man against God to start with. Okay. But like the passage we read out of Jeremiah, you know, for the most part, people are sheep. I mean, they engage in their own little activities, their own weaknesses, their own sensualities. But the wicked men, as he put it, among my people, are like fowlers lying in wait. They set a trap. They catch men. What they catch men with is their philosophies. See, the second force that's really at work, in addition to the latent rebellion of man, is the drives of the merchants for wealth and power, who are then willing to promote and protect the philosophies that are going to springboard them to those positions. Ultimately, then there's Satan himself working the deception. So you've got to understand that all these people that work Satan's game are they themselves deceived. See, they have been deceived as to what the end of the line is. They've been deceived as to what happens when their own hearts stop. So, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 3 then. Now, this is Paul working on the Corinthians because of the fact that they're still behaving like the rest of the human race instead of stepping up and behaving as Christians. But on the other hand, what that does is that gives us commentary on the human race. 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 1, he said, I, brethren, could not speak to you as to spiritual men, but as to men of flesh. See, as to infants in Christ. I gave you milk to drink and not solid food, and you were not able to receive it. Indeed, even now you're not yet able, for you're still fleshly. For since there's jealousy and strife among you, are you not fleshly and are you not walking like mere men? Characteristic of the human race is strife and jealousy, see, which then results in constant division of every form. Another word for division is fragmentation. Now, Satan not only wants to fragment, you know, man to man to wife, parent to child, but Satan also wants to fragment the individual himself. Now, what has happened then, see, in this fragmentation that has occurred, the humanist brain has been split into two parts. And the goal of the propaganda is to make sure that those two parts don't get together. See? Example I'll use is that I've used before in a little bit different context. But a number of years ago, this guy beat on the door of our place where we're staying at 309 East Garfield, the old church building. And he told us that he was preparing to be a missionary to Macau. Macau is a Portuguese colony off the coast of China, or kind of a peninsula of China, very similar to Hong Kong as being a British colony. And so we, of course, aren't going to support that unless we ask some very good questions and get some very good answers. So as we got down to discussing the issue of the relationship of immersion to salvation, see, he's the guy that made the statement that he believed that immersion was necessary to salvation, but not essential. That's, of course, postmodern thought, but it's a classic idea of the split brain, that over here is necessary and over here is essential. Necessary, but not essential. So you have to split that brain. You have to fragment that brain into two different parts in order to think that way. That's modern man. He's fragmented. And so that's why he zones out on drugs. That's why he engages in entertainment. He just zones out. That's his whole purpose, is to zone out, because he can't handle really the fact that his brain is fragmented. Now, the fragmentation goes on in so many aspects of life. The would-be tyrants always use anarchy as a vehicle to impose tyranny. Anarchy is the precursor to tyranny. And there's five steps in that the communists themselves, who actually have this all codified, they've got it all nailed down to a science. They've written their theoretical texts. They've actually implemented their techniques, and they work. But the first step is to find an issue on which to divide the people. See, to get the people fighting against each other. So there's a lot of issues like that in many areas of the world. They used what was called agrarian reform. Now, agrarian reform sounds pretty exciting, you know. And like in the Philippines, for example, you've seen pictures I had of those guys out there harvesting rice. A guy will have three little plots of rice, about from me to Ken White and about over to Leanne Long. There'll be about three or four plots of rice there. That's his rice farm. Now, he doesn't own the land. He just rents it. And so he harvests that by hand, and then you see those guys out there whapping the heads of the rice on a board and having the rice fall into kind of a blanket that they have down there to catch it. Gary knows exactly what I'm talking about. Okay. And then is the rice harvest, so that time of year comes to a close. The owner sends a big truck through, and so if a guy's got 40 sacks of rice sitting out on the front of his place, then the truck comes and takes 20 of them, because he's the owner. So the guy did all that work, and he gets half. So you see, the communists, when they start talking agrarian reform, how bad it is for one guy to own all that property and everybody else to be serfs on the land, you see they have a ready issue in which they can begin to divide the people. United States of America, they've used lots of them, because the biblical, the moral base, the legacy of freedom that's here, is much more entrenched than it is in any other country in the history of the world. So they used the black and white. See, the issue of race. They used, and they began working that pretty strongly in the 1930s. And they ran two separate programs at the same time. They wanted a separate black republic or separate black nation at the same time as they wanted full integration. See, two exact opposite things, so that they could play whichever way they wanted to play to the crowd. The goal wasn't to solve any problems. Goal was to find an issue of which to divide the people and get them fighting among themselves, not recognizing who the enemy, the merchant, so to speak, and his drive, the banker, and his drive for wealth and power was actually fomenting that in order to carry out anarchy. You know, we've seen that escalate in this country. Now we've got the Hispanic white, Hispanic black divide. We've got La Raza operating throughout the Hispanic community. They want an independent nation called Aztlan. At the same time, they want full integration and complete American rights, even though they're not citizens. You see, both of those are running two opposite things at the same time. They're not interested in solving the problem. They're interested in using the problem to get the people divided. So that's the first thing they do, is they find an issue on which to divide the people. Then the second thing they do is they provide the appearance of popular support. See, in other words, now they start giving it media coverage. So on May 1st, okay, what were we treated to this last year? We were treated to, millions of Hispanics, at least according to the news media, marching the streets demanding full rights as American citizens without being American citizens, right? And wasn't it interesting how many of them were carrying Mexican flags? See, now we're getting the appearance of popular support. There are whole cities in the United States that absolutely will not turn if, say, an illegal alien gets caught in a traffic violation. They flat won't turn them in. It's their policy not to. So you've got the appearance of popular support. Another issue is the gay straight issue. See, the issue is created, it's developed, it's fomented to split the public. And then we've been treated to about 15 years of primetime television programming to let us know that the gay lifestyle is superior to the straight lifestyle. See, and that the only normal guys are queer. That means that normal is queer or something, But that's, you see how the appearance of popular support is created in this process. Now, the average guy is sitting there, man, this is, how come I'm the only guy that's really seem to be loony? I mean, this seems way out to me, but I guess I better keep my mouth shut because I look like I'm way out there. See, that's how it's done. When you create the appearance, it doesn't necessarily have popular support. It's the appearance of popular support that's created through the media. Now, the next thing, step three in the process of fragmenting the people, is to neutralize the opposition. Sometimes neutralizing the opposition just simply means killing them. When some of the early black guys started to speak out against civil rights, recognizing that really the issue really wasn't civil rights, it was a communist revolution. The thugs had actually come and cut the people's tongues out in the black community. A number of years ago, we had a black man speak here at the building. His name was Thompson Galinda from South Africa. Now, he's black, okay, from South Africa. He was opposed to apartheid. He was in favor of apartheid. He was opposed to the Nelson Mandela and the South African African National Congress. Thank you. And whose members, by the way, were almost the same as the South African Communist Party. But I remember picking him up, and then I took him down to KBZK. Where the television was going to interview him for the evening news. And I get there, there's these really two tall Dutch looking gals, and they were from South Africa, and they were there to meet him. Now, he was about my height. He's about, you know, 5'6", 5'7". And, you know, these gals were about 6 feet tall, Afrikaners from Elizabethtown, South Africa. They knew of him. Now, he lived in the township. That is, the center was the whites, and then the blacks or coloreds, whatever, lived in other sections. But they told me, When they went in to interview him, I talked to the ladies. They said, that is a very brave man. See, because he opposed the policies of the African National Congress, even though he's black, what the communists were doing was firebombing. He had a chain of grocery stores, and he had delivery vans. And they firebombed. They burned paraffin. Instead of having propane heaters, they had paraffin heaters. And so they have blocks of paraffin in the supermarket. These guys had firebombed the paraffin section, set the store on fire, blew up the delivery vans, blew up his house, blew up his sister's house. See, he went through all that because he saw what was coming. See, wait a minute, he's black. How come they're doing it to him? See, because he was part of the opposition. He knew what was going on. So they had to neutralize him. Not only do it, they do it by physical intimidation, but they also do it by name calling. So, for example, if I say that homosexuality is a sin, and I may read a little section of the Apostle Paul out of Romans, then I'm a homophobe. You know, I'm intolerant. I'm engaged in hate speech. See, that's all terminology designed to neutralize the opposition. See, well, I mean, who wants to be a homophobe? You know, phobia is fear of something. See, I mean, you know, do you like the idea that you're full of hate? See how those are prejudicial terms that they just take and they glue onto you. See, it's done to further the agenda of dividing the people. Then the next thing they do is they engage in what they call nonviolent demonstrations. You know, Gay Day parades, May Day parades. See, all those sort of things are designed at some point to create a backlash. So that at some point, violence breaks out. Now, they actually like the violence because the violence then starts to produce the anarchy. And so the parades become more and more open, the demonstrations become more and more open. And then if the backlash doesn't automatically develop, they themselves will pretend to be on the opposite side and do the backlash themselves in order to get the publicity. So you have to start asking the questions, you know, I mean, why was Martin Luther King killed? See, those are questions you have to ask. But the result of this continued over and over again escalates into an anarchy so bad that revolution takes place, and following the revolution, you have a Napoleon that's happy to come on the scene and bring you peace and order. See, nothing new under the sun. Ultimately, then, it's Satan's program. See, Satan is actually engaged in the program of fragmentation. The mind, the man, between men, see, in order to carry out his ultimate tyrannical agenda. What Satan, of course, is opposed to is Christianity. That is his warfare. And so all of these things are step-by-step orchestrated. It's kind of like people are being herded, like sheep. You know, they know that they're being herded, but they're not for sure where they're going. They know that they're carrying out certain personal interests that may not necessarily be right. But they're being herded step by step, slowly, over generations, into a collectivist corral, into a time of total tyranny, wherein Christianity itself and Christian values would be totally outlawed. See, it happened in Judah. It happened in Israel before that. It will happen again. Now, the only solution, of course, is for us to understand the seriousness of the times and to do everything we can right now to start making disciples. See, if you have to look a little bit nuts sometimes to engage in your discussion, see, you just got to be more people opening their mouths and open their mouths in an excited way about something called the good news. Because what we do have is good news. We have good news for people's personal lifestyle. We have the good news that will bring the person the only place where there's inner peace and a clean conscience. We've got the only place that will bring a only message that will bring victory over sin and self and circumstance in life. And we've got the only message, see, that will carry a person on into eternity. See, what we have is we have the answers to all the questions. We have been given everything pertaining to life and godliness. That's something we should be excited about. And so what we just need to do is just start running those mouths. You know, not everybody's going to listen. A lot of people are going to think you're nuts, intolerant, hateful, you know, outmoded, outdated, out of touch. But you just have to remember where the problem really is. And it's not you. Okay. It's somewhere else.